Hello and welcome to Culture with Robert Bound, who I am not. Robert Bound is this week celebrating his birthday in climes warmer than this, and so has handed the baton over to me, Andrew Muller. It is a literal baton as well. It's a shame we're on radio and you can't see it. It's marvellous. Today it is time for our monthly Something Old, Something New episode. That's where we speak to writers, designers, artists, musicians, anyone creative really with a story to tell about the songs, books, items, people, places, other flotsam and jetsam that have interested them during their career. This week, in our presenterless state, we're switching the format a little bit. I've invited in my friend Andrew Harrison, the former editor of esteemed music publications such as The Word and Q, now host of the pop culture podcast Big Mouth and producer of Brexit podcast Romaniacs. Together, we will be discussing the things that we have both drawn inspiration from, both old and new. Do stay tuned. Andrew Harrison, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Andrew Muller.
The way this show works, as we've explained a little bit at the top, and as regular listeners will be familiar with, is that we have two people who know each other in some professional context or other, discussing things old and new that have meant something to them. We should probably start by explaining how we know each other. I was trying to figure that out myself. I think basically it's best expressed as kind of veterans of opposing sides of the 90s music press wars.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, my background is I started on a music monthly called Select in the 1990s. I came straight out of college, and as luck would have it, there was a boom on, and I finished my finals on a Friday, and I was on a plane to San Francisco on the Monday to interview UB40. Imagine the glamour. So I never had to fight in the weekly trenches like you did, Andrew. Many listeners will be aware of this, but others will not know that there were at one time three weekly music newspapers that came out every Wednesday and which hated each other and fought like cats and dogs. And you were a man of the Melody Maker, weren't you?
I was a man of the Melody Maker, briefly and unhappily and reluctantly a man of the NME, but most definitely a Melody Maker person.
Mm. And so I never did the weekly thing. I went straight into colour magazines. I was a child of a different generation. And it was terribly exciting because you could present the music you loved as colourfully and ridiculously as it was in your head. You know, usually it would be a bunch of like five really grubby looking chaps sitting in a pub in Camden. And you could turn them into these technical gods via the medium of then newfangled glossy colour print.
We should move on to the artefacts we're discussing. We will start with your something old. Well, we'll start with the something olds, but we'll start with your something old. And your something old is an old travel book.
It is an old travel book. It's a book called In Europe, Travels Through the 20th Century by a chap called Geert Mak. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly there. It's Geert Mak. He's a Dutch journalist. And the conceit of the book is fantastically simple and it works amazingly well. In the last year of the 20th century, Geert Mak travels through Europe. He does it chronologically. He starts in 1914 with the Edwardian era, with Amsterdam, Paris, London, Berlin, Vienna. And he finishes 1989 to 1999 in Bucharest, Novi Sad, Srebrenica and Sarajevo. And this was commissioned as an ongoing newspaper column by, let me find the paper and try to pronounce it properly, NBC Handelsblad.
Yes, that sounds plausible, near enough, I think.
And he writes 300 columns in the course of a year, and they all appear in the bottom right-hand front page of NBC Handelsblad. And what you get is an amazingly dense, amazingly informative, but incredibly readable travelogue. It's history as travelogue, it's travelogue as history. You encounter tales that, you know, as a British person, it made me feel incredibly undereducated. I'd never heard, for instance, of the Dutch Hongerwinter, which came at the end of the Second World War, when the Nazis had effectively, it was all over. The Nazis had been defeated, but they left the Dutch to starve. You know, we in Britain know little or nothing of this. And you know, my main feeling about In Europe by Geert Mak is that a copy of this should have been handed to every single British person before they voted in the EU referendum, because it really does show you that we know nothing at all of this thing we are flouncing out of. I mean, I spent a lot of my time now, you mentioned it earlier, producing a podcast called Romaniacs, and the clue is in the name. We are not in favour of leaving the EU. And the sense of impotent rage that comes from seeing a question answered from ignorance. I think it's safe to say that people were not fully informed of what they were voting for or what future they were voting for. Revisiting this book, which was a gift to me from my uncle, Anth Ginn, he said, you need to read this. And he was absolutely right. It became the book that I actually pass on to everybody now. Anybody says, I need something to read, I give them a copy of In Europe. Reading this again, just made me realise, you know, that we've not just voted in ignorance during the EU referendum, we've existed within the EU in total ignorance of the richness, the pathos, the tragedy, the epicness of the European story. We are the people sat in the corner of the party on our phone thinking about ourselves while greatness is happening right in front of you. Am I allowed to read a little bit out?
I can see absolutely no reason why not.
A little tiny bit, if I can find it. Right, here we go. This is from chapter 27, Chartwell. We're in the middle, we're around the time of the war. The fall of France, wrote the American journalist Rose Waldeck from Bucharest in 1940, formed a climax to 20 years of failure of the promises of democracy to handle unemployment, inflation, deflation, labour unrest, party egoism, and whatnot. Europe, tired of herself and doubtful of the principles she had been living by, felt almost relieved to have everything settled, not satisfactorily, but in such a way that it absolved her of all responsibility. She's talking about the initial German victories in the Second World War. And I just look at that and I think that's Britain, tired of everything, tired of its failure to handle its own problems and embracing awful things, becoming comfortable with awful, awful things. That's just one little snippet from 300 pages of utterly fascinating stuff.
Do the judgments he's made in that book hold up?
I think they hold up doubly.
Because that's
so.
always the tricky bit about journalism.
I think they hold up for many reasons. One is, he doesn't finish with a ponderous, and so, whither Europe in the 21st century? You know, he's presented as a picture of it in the 20th century, and you know the conclusions are there for us to draw. But the thing that I think makes it an even more poignant, particularly for the British, an even more poignant read at the moment, is that you see in Hitmark's History of Europe, that we began the 20th century as the most admired people in the world. The Germans imitate our dress. The French imitate our language. The Russian court only allows its young men to marry English girls. We are the most admired people at the pinnacle of our, not just our power, but our kind of moral presence in the world. Everybody loves us. This book ends in 1999, by which time we're sort of not quite the thing. God preserve us from the chapter that he writes now, where he describes Britain electing irrelevance, choosing to just strop off from this epic here. You know, we're very, very used to the epic history of the United States. We're very, very used to people reading the grand sweep, the plains, Manifest Destiny, you know, New York, Chicago, you name it. We're not used to seeing Europe treated in that way. And from this book, I got that. This is the great European history. And the great pathos for me is that we have written ourselves out of it.
Well, you have there sold at least one copy of In Europe's Geert Mak, Geert Mak's In Europe. It's that way around, isn't it?
It is. I hope I've sold a few more copies. Whenever it's anybody's birthday, I buy them this book. It's great. It's really easy. In fact, I actually got it for a Dutch friend, and she was full of stuff about Holland that she didn't know. And she actually saw Geert Mak in a cafe in Amsterdam and texted me a picture. She sent me a creep shot of my hero.
Amazing. That brings me on to my something old. I get to impose my tastes on the conversation now, which is going to be exciting for you, because this is a musical one, and as we have run up against once or twice before, the Venn diagram of Andrew Harrison and Andrew Muller's musical tastes, the overlap is not a big one. I think there's the Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah, it's a thin sliver.
It's a very thin sliver.
You can fit just two people in it.
Well, Neil Tennant and Chris Lowe. I think it's fair to say that the musician I want to discuss falls firmly in my side of it. But he's an Australian musician called Paul Kelly, and he has been a large part of my life, and I think the large part of the lives of millions of Australians, especially those of us of a certain age. But I saw him play on Saturday night, and it occurred to me that I'd seen him play solo shows in London, because he often just comes with an acoustic guitar, but I hadn't seen him play with a full band. Mm-hmm. I think the last time I saw him play with a full band might have been at the Tivoli in Sydney, which got knocked down about 20 years ago at some point in the late 1980s. And it was very strange seeing him in full cry. To explain him to people who don't know him, he's kind of the closest thing Australia has to a sort of a Bruce Springsteen figure. He's our sort of, you know, avuncular rock and roll poet laureate.
He's the Bruce Springsteen.
He is, thank you, the Bruce Springsteen. Except he musically and lyrically, he lacks Springsteen's sort of bombast. And I mean that in a non-judgmental way. Oh. I'm a big Springsteen fan. Kelly writes very deceptively complicated, outwardly simple, deceptively complicated songs. And they are just everyman storytelling variety songs. Mm-hmm. But at the show on Saturday night, he played the whole new album in its entirety first, which is a bold move.
Yes.
Which, in most artists, does provoke the sort of stampedes for the bar that somebody could die in. But that did not happen. But he came out of that into greatest hits modes, and he did two songs straight on top of each other, one called To Her Door and one called Before Too Long. And the response from an expat Australian audience was quite something to behold. To Her Door weirdly seems to have become Australia's Born to Run, although it's about a guy going back to where he came from rather than a couple fleeing. It's a song that I remember Robert Forster from the Go-Betweens wrote a really fine essay about once, just saying it's kind of an infuriating song to listen to as a songwriter, because the song itself is the first three chords you learn as a guitarist. It's G, C and D, or G, D and C in that order. It's almost insultingly simple, except there's an E minor in the chorus. There's barely a word longer than one syllable in the lyric, and it's this very straightforward story of this couple that split up, sort of have some time apart, then they get back together and you never quite know whether it's all worked out or not.
He was riding through the game in the pouring rain on McCafferty. To her door, to her door, to her door.
And you just think, why does this work? Why does a song like this get at people? And yet it does. And the effect it had on a room full of Australians was quite bizarre. It did remind me of seeing Springsteen in a Midwestern venue when they recognise the opening chord of Born to Run and the whole place goes absolutely berserk. And it was like that on Saturday. People hear that G being strummed into D and the whole place erupted. It was very weird.
Mm. Well, although, of course, Shepherd's Bush is essentially Australian sovereign territory anyway, isn't it? You have to show your passport to get in there. I can imagine that show. Well, the audience for a show like that is going to be very dedicated. And if he comes on and says, I'm going to play the entire new album, they'd be quite excited by that, wouldn't they?
They actually were. Whereas at that exact same venue years ago, I saw Ray Davies from the Kinks attempt the same thing. And really, he might as well have said the building is on fire for the effect it had on the audience, who'd obviously all paid their babysitter so they could hear Waterloo Sunset.
Yeah, play one the drummer knows, yes.
But, it was quite a weird and quite moving thing to watch, really. And I do wonder, and I wonder what you think about this as well, whether that idea of the musician that you grow up with is still something that can happen. Because Paul Kelly's had the first album of his that I knew and really loved was a double album called Gossip, which I think came out in Australia in about 1985. But that was his third or fourth album already. He'd already had a career going back to the late 70s, early 80s. So this is now someone who's been recording for, getting on for 40 years. Is that still possible?
I think so. I think there comes a point. If you're the kind of person who follows bands, if you're the kind of person who's a fan, maybe with a capital F, maybe just with a lowercase f, there comes a point at which you're in for life with this outfit. And there are a few bands like that for me. Madness, for instance, one of the first bands I ever loved when I was a kid. And I still follow them. And I know that, they've gotten an awful lot older and so have I. But there's still a thing in there that I relate to. And I think some of their recent albums, particularly Liberty of Norton Folgate, it is their masterpiece. They are the best songs they've written. They're certainly not the biggest hits, and they're certainly not the kind of crowd-pleasing fun stuff. But in terms of music with depth that still speaks to you but retains that fun, pure joy aspect you remember from when you were a kid, I often think they are the best bands. Who really develops a new favourite band in their 40s? Who really falls in love with a band forever in their 40s?
Well, this is why whenever you ask people to name their favourite albums, they all came out the year that person left school.
Well, or I'd say, in my case, the year I went to big school, the Specials by the Specials.
The Specials by the Specials was literally the first album I ever bought.
Well, you made a very good choice there, actually.
I know. The trouble is it's too good. Nobody believes that when I tell them.
It's a very good.
It's true.
The first one I ever got was Sladest by Slade.
That's a judicious choice as well. There was another song Paul Kelly did as well, which I was hoping he would do, because I don't think he's ever bothered to actually record it. I think the only recordings of it are live, and I suspect at least he wrote it mostly to play to Australians overseas. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to talk about it because it means I get an excuse to swear on air. The song's called Every Fucking City.
We argued on the Channel train to Paris. The Van Rouge helped us make it sweet again. But by the time that we got down to Lyon, everything I said was wrong, and you cursed me in the rain.
Right.
And it is a chronicle of a backpacking couple breaking up and getting back together as they...
a uniquely Australian experience.
Well, exactly, as they tour around Europe. And again, there was something really sweet about the way the entire of Shepherd's Bush just bellowed along with the man's final lament, which I think I quote correctly is, "And now I'm in a restaurant in Stockholm and the waiter here wants me to know his name and I can order sandwiches in 7 different languages, but every fucking city's just the same." So, but it's a great song, and it was lovely to hear it. And I do... Paul Kelly, it's a funny one. He's never really had a massive hit or a massive presence outside Australia, but he's one of those people, one of those artists that I recommend to people who want to get some understanding of, I think, you know, how Australians talk and think and see the world. And if you have any interest at all in actually well-written biographies or autobiographies by musicians, his book, How to Make Gravy, which came out a few years ago, is every bit as good as I imagined it would be.
I think there's a small festival in this, you know, because if you've got the Australian Bruce Springsteen, every country has its own Bruce Springsteen. There's going to be a French Bruce Springsteen somewhere. There's probably a Spanish one. There's obviously the American Bruce Springsteen. He's quite good, I heard. Put on the Springsteens of the world. Unite. I think it's a goer. How coherent is the story of the working man? Darkness on the edge of, you know...
Bilbao or Lisbon or Amsterdam or... I just get the impression that all of that is... every single artist on that bill is either going to be absolutely amazing or possibly the worst thing you've ever heard in your life.
Sounds exciting to me.
Okay, well, we'll talk about this afterwards. We could promote this. It will be the bankrupting of both of us. We do now need to move along to the something new section of the show. You want to talk about a TV show called Legion. Now, again, I have a suspicion that the Venn diagram of television that you and I enjoy is probably not a single circle either.
Yeah, it's going to be another tiny, tiny sliver.
Okay, so Legion is what exactly?
Legion is the least known and, for my money, the best Marvel TV adaptation. And I'm sure the listeners will be aware that Netflix has been adapting many of the more marginal Marvel Comics characters into TV series. So we've had Daredevil, we've had Jessica Jones, we've had Iron Fist, we've had Luke Cage, and they've all come together in this kind of ensemble show, The Defenders, which is... The idea is that these are also street-level heroes. They're not the big guys like Thor and Iron Man. They are your friendly neighborhood guy who happens to live around the corner with a drink problem or a terrible headache. And they've come together as the Defenders, which is a kind of cut-price corner shop Avengers. But for my money, Netflix did a great job with Daredevil. I think Jessica Jones is a fantastic series. The others have been quite disappointing. This one, Legion, I'm amazed that so few people have heard of it because... For my money, it is the best of the lot. It is an adaptation by the FX channel, which is a division of Fox, put together by Noah Hawley, who was the showrunner on Fargo. And the idea is that you're aware of the Marvel Comics universe of mutants and so forth and superpowers, which is usually kind of looked at as a kind of wish fulfillment power fantasy thing, particularly in the blockbuster movies like The Avengers and Thor and Captain America and so forth. And they've been very interesting at kind of depicting a modern idea of heroism and a modern idea of what actually constitutes both the kind of the dominant movie trope of the moment, but what actually is a hero. Legion, for me, is the most adult one because the central character, we are not aware whether he actually has abnormal powers or whether he's mentally ill. The entire thing seems to be taking place inside his head. And the reason I love it so much is that this show, unlike any of the other Marvel adaptations, has brought in the sheer visual beauty of comic books onto the screen. Legion looks like an episode of The Avengers. Or it looks like an episode of The Prisoner. It's highly stylized. It looks like Gurney Slade or something. It's a super technical, heavily contrasty, modern version of that semi-Carnaby pop art psychedelia that was available in late 60s British movies. Every lens is a fisheye lens. The heroine, she's called Syd Barrett. and we are never quite sure in this show whether we're simply watching David, the central character David, whether we're just watching his hallucinations and delusions. He's in a mental hospital, or is he? He's got superpowers, or has he? He's got a quest to free the woman that he's fallen for in the mental hospital from a dilemma or a problem which I won't describe because it'll kind of destroy the show. Or has he? It's shot beautifully. The central performance by Dan Stevens, who you might know from Downton Abbey. I didn't watch Downton Abbey.
I didn't watch Downton Abbey.
Okay, the listeners may know. Apparently he was the love intro. He was the main hunk or something in Downton Abbey. He delivers a fantastic kind of One flew over the Avengers headquarters as he sits in the corner of this, I might add, beautifully stylized mental hospital, sort of cracking his knuckles and twitching. And you're never sure of what's driving that. Is a deep-seated personality problem or the power within him trying to get out?
You went off your medication.
Wake up.
Why? We're just looking for the truth.
David!
Which you promised to tell. I told you they took her.
Sydney Barrett, the girl who disappeared.
She didn't disappear. She took my place, and I took hers.
Wait, what?
The reason I love comic book stuff, the best of the comic book stuff, like Daredevil or Jessica Jones, it takes recognisable human character traits and hyper-exaggerates them, places them within a fantastical context in order for you to think further about them. But for me, Legion is the best of the lot because it delivers at the fantasy level. It delivers at the it is a look at mental illness. The villain of the show, played in part by the wonderful Aubrey Plaza from Parks and Recreation, is clearly both an externalization and an internalization of his mental problems. It's a dramatization of people fighting their demons. And the thing I loved most of all about it is, you know, when you love comics like me, I mean, I started reading comics when I was a little kid, and the part of it that I still love is the visual luxury, the visual lushness of it, the fact that you can, for, you know, what was then 10p and is now £2, have amazing psychedelic pop art before you by the most talented out there minds of your generation. You can get it in a corner shop. And this is, for me, is the only show that's nailed that look. The comic that it's adapted from was drawn by a guy called Bill Sienkiewicz, whose style is an incredible synthesis of different styles. It's pointillist, it's cubist, it's surrealist, it's realist, it's, you know, it's everything from Roy Lichtenstein out to, you know, Gavin Turk, for instance. He brings everything together. The best thing about it is it's a secret. Nobody knows about this show. So I've been able to evangelize about it. They do now. I urge you. It's still available, I believe, on demand on Sky. So get out there and have a look.
Okay, well, that moves us on to my something new, which I also bought in because I thought you might enjoy it as well. It's not a populist manoeuvre, this one. This is a book called The Experiment, George's Forgotten Revolution, 1918-21 by Eric Lee. I liked it because I'm a massive nerd who enjoys reading books about obscure occurrences in weird pockets of Europe, etc. So I would literally have read this for fun because that's the kind of guy I am. It's very smart and it's very interesting and it's very well written, but it's also essentially, well, the great thing about talking about history books is you don't have to worry about spoiler alerts because people basically know how they're going to end. Yeah. But this is a hopeful exercise in social democracy conducted in the foothills of the Caucasus in the years after World War One, which eventually gets, you know, completely crushed beneath the Soviet juggernaut as so much did. But it is an interesting book as well about how an attempt to find a moderate view, to be pragmatic, if you will, centrist, is just always has seemed to be an eternally vulnerable thing to do. When, yeah. And if you're the kind of person like I am, and I suspect you are as well, who doesn't see the particular problem with taking a pragmatic and, if you will, centrist view of things,
yeah.
It's quite strange that history keeps teaching us this lesson, that it will eventually get consumed by wilder and more extreme forces from without.
I think we're seeing it, that particular thing played out both in Britain between the hardline Brexiteers and everybody else who seems to be standing in a daze, and in America between the all-out Breitbart Trump Brigade and everybody else who's standing around in a daze unable to know what to do. I think it's because if you are a person who is a compromiser and a reacher out by nature, you're going to always be at a competitive disadvantage to the utterly ruthless and the utterly committed. And I've not read the book, but I certainly will be reading it. But if, you know, if you're trying to build a social democratic republic and you're up against Stalin.
Well, exactly. You're going to bet on Stalin. And it does make a good point of explaining how the whole thing was compromised, that from the off, because Georgia immediately after World War One felt itself vulnerable, and not without reason, probably to Turkey. So they tried to do a deal with the Germans to send troops to protect them in exchange for the natural resources. And then, of course, Germany lost the war. So they then found themselves occupied by the British, who weren't terribly pleased with them for having sided with the Germans. And nonetheless, they did manage to keep a semblance of the social democratic dream alive for 3 years before, as you say, Stalin, who, of course, as a native Georgian, had a...
had a dog in the fight.
He did have a dog in the fight. I'm not sure how big his dog in the fight was as early as 1918-21. But nevertheless, the Soviet Union did what the Soviet Union generally does. But do you see that? Because the reason I brought that in to talk to you about it as well is whether, when you're covering this stuff on your Romaniacs podcast, whether that's how Britain now seems to you. And this is a country which, and as you said earlier when you were talking about Geert Max in Europe, used to be admired around the world, I think, for among many other reasons. It's mostly consensual, reasonable, non-extreme politics. It has always been a defining defining aspect, rather, of British politics, going back probably all the way to Cromwell, that there's not been a huge tolerance for the ideologue or the demagogue or the extremist in British political life.
Well, that's what I find terrifying about now, because I think we've suddenly developed a taste for it. And one of the most dispiriting aspects of the current political discussion in Britain is that it's all carried out by borrowed third-hand zingers and third-hand memes and quotelets that ping around on social media. And one of the most chilling ones that I've seen occurring is the line that moderation is the new extremism.
That doesn't make any sense.
Of course, it doesn't have to make sense. People are throwing this around to encourage them in their own extreme beliefs. The idea that it's the centre that's the danger, that the centre is compromised and therefore the centre is wrong and evil, and it is the centre which has delivered us into the supposed misery that we're going to be liberated from, either by Corbynism or by hard Brexit. Now, you know, given those two choices, it is an immensely dispiriting prospect to see your future diverging on down one of those two paths. However, it's certainly the case that having had a broadly centrist government for the past, you know, governments for the past 20 years or so, their failure to deliver and perhaps their complacency has been the author of their own misfortune. I don't think that then means you write off a centrist, pragmatic, compromising path forever. I think that what we have at the moment is that the best minds of the centre have both run out of energy and have been prostrated by the terrible events of the past few years. I mean, pretty much everything that could go wrong for a consensus-minded politician or voter has gone wrong. We've seen extremism encouraged in every dimension, and never mind existing party political structures, almost nothing has developed that's able to handle what social media throws at us, the way that fake news and incredibly distorted news flies around unchallenged. The way that we went very quickly in a period of 2 years, and I'm talking about Britain and America now, we went very quickly from a situation wherein uttering a moderate lie would end your career as a politician to a situation where key politicians, including the President of the United States, now lie openly as a matter of course, and when challenged simply say, "My point stands."
Well, on that happy note, that does bring us to the end of today's show. A reminder of those last two things we were discussing. The experiment, Georgia's Forgotten Revolution, 1918-21, by Eric Lee, is out now, published by Zed Books. I do recommend that very much. And Legion is available to watch on Fox On Demand now, and Andrew recommends that very much. And frankly, he's just about sold me on it as well. Thanks to my guest, Andrew Harrison. You can listen to his podcast, Big Mouth and Romaniacs, on audioboom.com now. You have been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly Fisher. I'm Andrew Muller. Tune in at the same time next week. Robert Bound will be back at the helm. And it is, again, an actual helm. It is a shame this is radio and you can't see that, but it's right here. I'm looking at it. But for now, thanks for tuning in.